I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. September is Sickle Cell Awareness Month. Sickle cell disease or sickle cell anemia is an inherited blood disorder that causes a healthy, rounded red blood cell to become rigid, sticky, and to fold up like a sickle or crescent shape. These cells reduce blood flow throughout the body, creating pain, damage to vital organs, and life-threatening conditions. Sickle cell anemia is one of the most prevalent genetic disorders in the world. The condition is more common in certain ethnic groups, including people of African descent, as well as Middle Eastern, Asian, Indian, and Mediterranean descent. About 300,000 children are born with sickle cell disease every year, according to the World Health Organization. Many of them die before their fifth birthday, but observers say there is hope with early intervention and access to proper care.
Sickle cell disease causes the body to produce sickle or disc-shaped red blood cells, making it difficult for patients to transport oxygen from the lungs. Dr. Prebo Barango is the medical officer at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Africa.
Sickle cell is the most important and most prevalent genetic disease in the African region. Globally, we have about 120 million people with sickle cell, and 60% of these are in the African region.
Uganda has been dealing with a high burden of sickle cell disease for over 70 years and was one of the first countries to report it as such in 1949, according to research published in the Lancet Global Health. Daniel Odor is the executive director of the Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation. He says the numbers are still too high.
In Uganda, about 20,000 to 25,000 children are born with sickle cell annually in the country. And out of that, between 50 to 80% do not cross to their fifth birthday.
Medical experts say early diagnosis is key to help reduce the long-term impact of sickle cell disease on patients. However,
in the African region, most countries with a high burden of sickle cell disease don't have newborn screening in place that is comprehensive enough.
Odor says testing is an essential aspect of the organization's strategy to raise awareness.
We have been in position to cause awareness and cause sensitization and also scale up testing in the country. Much as this is being done, there are also still other challenges. For example, there is lack of testing kits in certain areas.
There are treatment options once a child is diagnosed with sickle cell disease, but experts note that getting the right care can be costly and isn't always accessible in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, especially in rural areas. Dr. Barango says there are some ways to remedy this.
To decentralize care to the lowest level of care available, which is the PHC, so that people that live in the rural and peri-urban areas can have access to this early diagnosis for sickle cell disease. So once they are diagnosed early, they follow a certain path of care. The other is on making sure that hydroxyurea is a medicine that has been shown to reduce frequency of sickle cell crisis in developed countries. It's a challenge in the region. It will also be important if hydroxyurea is made more accessible.
Research shows that people with sickle cell anemia are more prone to infections. One of the major problems for a child with sickle cell is the occurrence of strokes because of the blockage of blood flow to the brain, which is most crucial at age 5. Medical experts say the dangerous incidents can be prevented by blood transfusion.
For more on sickle cell anemia, I spoke with Dr. Prebo Barango, medical officer at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Africa. Dr. Prebo Barango, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you please explain what sickle cell anemia is?
Sickle cell disease is a hereditary condition, and it's due to inheriting genes that are responsible for the red blood cells from both parents. So you can have a carrier, having one normal A gene and the other one S, SA is the normal one. So if you have the two, if you inherit both S genes from your parents, then your hemoglobin is SS, then you are sickle, then you are a sickler. If you have the AS, that is inheriting only one S from a parent, then you are a carrier of the sickle cell. It means that you live, you are apparently normal, but then if you get married to someone that has it, that is also a carrier, there's a possibility of giving birth to a child with the sickle cell disease.
How much of a problem is sickle cell disease on the continent?
It's a huge problem. Sickle cell is the most important and most prevalent genetic disease in the African region. Globally, we have about 120 million sickle cell patients, people with sickle cell, and 60% of these are in the African region. So it's quite a major genetic disorder in the African region.
The people who have sickle cell disease, what are some of the symptoms that they experiment? What is their life like?
Okay, thanks. So the challenge with the inherited sickle cell hemoglobin is that the hemoglobin, the blood now sickles. It's not the normal red blood cell is biconcave, but with the sickle cell, it becomes, it forms like the name is, it forms a sickle. So it blocks small blood vessels. So the challenge with that is that the blockage of the small blood vessels leads to anemia, and it leads to other consequences of sickle cell. So you can have bone pain crisis if the blockage is in the small capillaries in the bone. You can have in the liver, you can have an enlargement of the liver or the spleen. It could also give rise to stroke if the blockage is in the brain. So those are the key challenges based on the inheritance of that abnormal hemoglobin.
What are some of the triggers for someone who has this abnormality? Can outside conditions trigger the disease in someone who has the trait?
Yes, things that will stress the body to require a lot of oxygen or more blood flow will trigger it. So things like extreme cold, things like infection. If they have a common infection, if they have extremes of weather, will trigger crisis in people with sickle cell.
What do they experience during a crisis?
Now, it depends on the kind of crisis. So if it's bone pain crisis, for example, it's severe pain that will require plenty of analgesics and medical treatment. If they have what we call sequestration crisis, in which case the blood is sequestered in the spleen, it leads to anemia. They might require blood transfusion. If it's stroke, it needs to be managed medically also. So it depends on the crisis and the management, but basically they require a lot of, usually during this crisis, they require hospital admissions.
Do people who have sickle cell have like a lifespan limitation?
Not necessarily. Unfortunately, right now, the way it is now is that where the age you live up to is determined by where you are born. So we have what is called the comprehensive care for sickle cell disease. People that live in developed countries that have sickle cell live longer because there's early diagnosis. Early diagnosis through newborn screening. So the newborn screening, so they are detected very early, and then preventive measures are undertaken, including getting the necessary vaccinations and immunizations, getting the necessary treatment, and preventing other infections, things like that, in people in developed countries. Unfortunately, in the African region, most countries with a high burden of sickle cell disease, don't have newborn screening in place that is comprehensive enough. So ab initio is the first challenge. So people with sickle cell in the African region, in most countries, are diagnosed late, at a late stage, when the complications have already been setting in. Maybe the child has been having recurrent pain crisis, then they are diagnosed.
So in terms of solutions, where do you see the urgencies?
So the urgencies will be to scale up newborn screening, early diagnosis. Second would be to decentralize care to primary, to the lowest level of care available, which is the PHC, so that people that live in the rural and peri-urban areas can have access to this early diagnosis for sickle cell disease. So once they are diagnosed early, they follow a certain path of care, meaning they have to get the vaccinations that they require, they have to get the prophylaxis against malaria that they require, they need to get the all the other medicines that they require to stay healthy, and then the advice that they need. So that's really the most important urgent thing to be done. The other is on making sure that hydroxyurea is a medicine that has been shown to reduce frequency of sickle cell crisis in developed countries. Access to hydroxyurea and the lab mechanisms necessary to monitor the hydroxyurea in patients is a challenge in the region. It will also be important if hydroxyurea is made more accessible.
Dr. Prebo Barango, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Leonard, thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking with you again.
That was Dr. Prebo Barango, Medical Officer at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Africa. 28-year-old Ami Mukundwa was born in DRC. His family moved to Rwanda when he was a toddler. In his childhood, Amir was always sickly but had no clue what disease he was suffering from. Later on, he went to the hospital where blood tests were done and he was diagnosed with sickle cell anemia. He is of 7 siblings, but only him and one of his siblings suffer from sickle cell anemia. He shares his story.
Sickle cell anemia, it's a disease that doesn't cure. So you live with it, you grow with it, and you die with it. But if you take medicines as it's prescribed with your doctor, you can live even 70 years old with it without any problem. But the problem with it, it's that medicines of sickle cell anemia, they are very, very expensive. And some of them, we don't find them in Africa. When I'm in crisis of sickle cell anemia, I always cry. I'm 28 years old. Soon I will be 29 years old. You can't control the pain. My back, my legs, and my arms. I can't move from the bed to go to the toilet or move from the bed to go get something to eat, to drink. No. When it's cold, either it's raining or we wake up in a cold weather. Trust me, that's the worst part. You can't move. You can't go outside. If you get out of the house and you meet with the cold weather, trust me, at that time, not even 5 minutes, not even 60 seconds, you will start to feel the pain. There is a big difference between the day before the pandemic of COVID-19 to today. Before, we used to get medicines on a cheap price. And we used to get at any pharmacy. You can get it easily as long as you show them your paper that you have a sickle cell anemia. But now it's very, very difficult to find them. Nowadays, we are not getting medicines in Rwanda. We are not getting them because they are very, very hard to get them here. And so when I'm in crisis, I used injections because those medicines they prescribe us to drink, we can't find them anywhere around. All I have to tell you guys is always be strong and always take your medicines on time and daily, every day. Don't miss even one day, because if you miss one or two days with your medicine, the day the crisis will come to you, it will be painful, very painful. So be strong wherever you are. God is with us and it will be okay.
That was 28-year-old Amir Mukundwa in DRC sharing his story of sickle cell disease. Now, experts say for many sickle cell patients in Africa, access to resources and proper care remains a challenge. A non-profit organization in Uganda, the Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation, aims to lessen the burden of sickle cell disease in the country by raising awareness and encouraging early diagnosis, among other things. Daniel Roy Odor is the executive director of the Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation. He shares some insight on the fight against sickle cell anemia in his country.
We are now in the month of September. This is the Sickle Cell Awareness Month, and this has come in right handy and to reflect or re-image the current situation of sickle cell in Uganda. Apparently, in Uganda, the burden of sickle cell still rages on, and very little attention has been given to sickle cell. However, the Ministry of Health and other implementing partners, like where I work at Uganda Sickle Cell, we have been in position to cause awareness and cause sensitization and also scale up testing in the country. Much as this is being done, there are also still other challenges. For example, you might find out that there is lack of testing kits in certain areas, even in government facilities. And we are the only organization currently that is doing testing for sickle cell traits in the country. In Uganda, about 20,000 to 25,000 children are born with sickle cell annually. And out of that, between 50 to 80% do not cross to their fifth birthday. And this is quite alarming. Can you imagine about if you have 25,000 children being born annually in the country and only about 50 to about 80% don't make it to their fifth birthday? This calls for a lot of intervention from quite a number of partners, not only the Ministry of Health. We call upon the World Health Organization, because even organizations like IMF, because sickle cell has not only become a disease, but also it is causing barriers to economic development in different families and even the entire nation or even Africa. Why? Imagine if you have a sickle cell patient in your home. Every week, you're almost spending money going to the hospital, and this leaves you with no penny at home. If you go by areas of higher prevalence, right now, in Uganda, in the northern part of the country, that's in Acholi, Bunjon, and then Lango, has more or less the same prevalence, but it is quite higher. And they actually have lots of taboos, apparently. Now, imagine a lady and a gentleman or couples are planning to get married. They even don't know their sickle cell status. We need to have sickle cell stand alone on that table of non-communicable diseases, because apparently sickle cell is embedded somewhere deep down and less funding goes to sickle cell. But if we have enough priorities on sickle cell, for example, if we use the same approach of how HIV was being tackled in the country, believe me, viewers, that the issue of sickle cell would really become very minimal if we use the same resources and the same vigor in HIV and reciprocate it in combating sickle cell disease. So we need all this, we need to galvanize all these efforts in ensuring that sensitization is accelerated in the country.
That was Daniel Roy Odor, Executive Director of the Uganda Sickle Cell Rescue Foundation. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Health authorities in Uganda are ramping up efforts to contain an outbreak of Ebola in the country after a case of the relatively rare Sudan strain was detected in the country's central Mubende district. A 24-year-old man showed symptoms and later died. The virus has now spread to neighboring Kiegewukwa and Kasanda districts, bringing the cumulative number of confirmed and suspected deaths to at least 23 and no less than 36 cumulative cases, including confirmed and probable cases, according to health authorities in the country. Dr. Amash Adalja, an infectious disease expert with the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health, who is also an infectious disease physician, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Ebola begins with flu-like symptoms after an incubation period that can last up to 21 days. Take a listen.
Starts out with fevers, chills, muscle aches and pains, sore throat. And what happens during that period of time is that the person's body is being infected with the virus, and eventually that infection affects the blood vessels, and people's blood pressure will plummet. They may have very severe vomiting, diarrhea. They may, in certain cases, have massive interference with the ability of their blood to clot, and this can have a fatality rate that ranges in the 60-70% ballpark, depending upon how quickly people are linked to treatment. So it is a very severe illness.
Talk about the situation, if you can, about what's happening in Uganda. How does it spread?
Ebola is a very scary and a very deadly disease, but it's not very contagious. It requires blood and body fluid exposure. So this is going to be close contact amongst family members, amongst people with healthcare workers, for example. If someone goes to a village health center and has symptoms of Ebola, those healthcare workers, if they're not wearing personal protective equipment, can get infected. It's really about making sure people have the appropriate personal protective equipment to take care of patients. And that usually is what's able to stop Ebola outbreaks once they understand how people are getting infected and put public health measures into place. And recall that Uganda is a place that's no stranger to Ebola outbreaks. They've had them in the past, so they know how to do this. It's a question of getting all of those resources mobilized in a time when a lot of public health resources have been diverted towards COVID-19.
So what should Ugandan authorities and those in neighboring countries, for that matter, be doing to prevent this Ebola strain from spreading?
Well, the first thing they need to do is increase awareness. People have to be cognizant of the fact that this virus is spreading in Uganda, and countries that border Uganda should be on the lookout for cases that may or may not be consistent with Ebola. They also have to demystify this disease to the general public, to stop myths about the virus from spreading, to tell people how you get it, what protective actions you need to take. They also have to make sure that local health workers have the resources to be able to find cases, to be able to diagnose cases, and to be able to take care of those cases in places where there's less risk of contagion. Traditionally, we've seen healthcare workers get infected with Ebola because they don't have adequate supplies to take care of those patients. That will all be something that's needed. What we don't want to see is draconian measures. We don't want to see travel bans. We don't want to see border closures. We don't want people to get in a situation where they're trying to hide Ebola cases like we saw in West Africa. Fortunately, Uganda is a place that's had Ebola, so they don't have that same issue, but we have seen a lot of those authoritarian measures and violence occur in West Africa back in 2013, 2014, as well as in the DRC with some outbreaks that have occurred in recent years.
That's Dr. Amash Adalja, an infectious disease expert with the Johns Hopkins University Center for Global Health and an infectious disease physician with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from New York. British scientists have found a way to increase the supply of kidneys available for transplant by altering the blood type of the organ. The discovery could be life-changing for people on the kidney donor wait list.
Chronic kidney disease has meant that Aisha Edmondson hasn't been able to work or spend time outside the house as much as she wants to. She's waiting for a kidney transplant, which could take up to 10 years.
During the pandemic, that's when I was told that I had 12 months to find a living kidney donor. And although I already knew that my condition was heading that way. It was still a bit of a shock, because I think that no matter how much you prepare, when you get news like that, you know, it's tough.
Researchers at the University of Cambridge have successfully altered the blood type of three donor kidneys. The research means that kidneys of different blood types could be made compatible for transplants if the donor kidney has its blood type altered to O, the universal blood type. Scientists took the oxygenated blood out of the donor kidney and then put blood infused with enzymes back in. This results in the kidney being converted to type O blood. A clinical trial hasn't yet been conducted. According to the National Health Service, 9% of total organ donations came from Black and ethnic minorities from 2020 to 2021.
People from ethnic minority backgrounds on average wait a year longer to receive a kidney transplant than people from a Caucasian background. So again, if this research helps to redress that balance, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Dr. McMahon's research will be published in the British Journal of Surgery later this year. And she wants to address minorities who might not be willing to donate.
A startup in Ghana is focusing on diversifying cancer research to include more African and African-American people to help develop better treatments. Take a listen.
Yamachi Biotech is a research and diagnostics startup in Accra, Ghana. Dr. Akakpo is a pathologist at the facility and says he thinks this lab could change African cancer studies forever.
Even though breast cancer has been studied extensively throughout the world, the truth is that most of the cases are not Africans. If you look at every study across the world, there are very few of them who are Africans. So what this does is that you come to the African population and study it, and that has effects on African Americans and any other group that has a basis in Africa. That's why this is so important. Without it, you don't have enough to relate to African breast cancer.
It's difficult to find and collect accurate data on cancer in Africa, but research by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services shows only about 2% of genomic study participants are of African descent.
We have one of the world's fastest growing burdens of cancer, and we have some of the highest cancer mortality rates anywhere in the world. So as much as HIV and malaria are problems, cancer is a huge problem, and it's actually a problem that is growing faster than those other problems. So I felt that for a new company starting out, we needed to focus on an area that was really important, but also was less traveled.
Yamachi's Ghanaian founders have created a laboratory equipped for molecular analysis, and researchers can collect data they say will aid the development of precision medicine for cancer patients in Africa and throughout the diaspora.
Treatment of cancer is not always going to be in the clinic, but treatment of cancer is going to be in the lab. Most treatments were started on a lab table. And if we need to find a cure, if we need to race for a cure in Africa for Africans, then we have to start it here.
The company has also made a testing kit for human papillomavirus, or HPV, that people can use at home. Research shows that infections like HPV increase the risk for liver cancer and cervical cancer. The American Cancer Society estimates more than a third of global cervical cancer deaths occur in Africa.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Mukbil Yabaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Is Heidi Adams, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society, culture, and politics. will go behind the headlines to analyze the news and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa, every Wednesday at 8.